Morning, church. I hope everybody is well this morning. I neglected last week to share some good news with you, so I'm going to do that at this time. I won't ask these folks to stand, but we do want to celebrate a great day a couple of weeks ago. First of all, we had Bobby Clark, who gave his life to Christ and was baptized, and also Lexi Hill. So let's celebrate with them. We're really, really proud of y'all, and you're part of our family, and so we want to be there for you, whatever the case might be, whatever comes in your life. We're really thankful for that move that you made, that step that you made. We're talking about the gospel, and specifically the fact that the gospel is good news. It is good news because Jesus has come and he has lived on this earth. And there's so many aspects of our life that we don't think about the good news of Jesus. And we want to make sure we understand when we talk about the gospel that it is good news. And if it isn't good news, then we must not really be talking about the gospel, because Jesus is good news to humanity. Amen? You know, I have made a lot of mistakes in my life. Too many to count. Don't have to hear any snarky comments from my family that's here. They would amen that. Lots of mistakes in my life. But I got to tell you, the year that I was a freshman in college has to be one of the worst. I mean, it was really bad. In fact, some of you, as Lisa and I and Adam and Jenny work with, and also Jeff and Brandy Hilfiker, as we all work with the college group, these college kids, young men and young women, not only the future of our church, but the actual church now, because we got some awesome college kids. And as we get to know them and hear about some of their, what they consider to be their fails, it doesn't even bother me, because you guys don't know how bad I failed. My first semester in college, I think I had probably a 1.0 grade point average. Not real good. I wrecked my car, driving like an idiot, not too good. Embarrassed my parents, which was the worst thing of all. I mean, everybody knew my dad, and I have to give it to him. He never let on that he was embarrassed, but I knew he was. Especially looking back now, I know how embarrassed I must have been to him. But he still believed in me, and he kept on encouraging me. But probably the most embarrassing thing in all of that, and all of this was how, all of this, this was not like a long drawn out thing. This all happened in one semester. All right, I had a job mopping floors, and I got fired from it. How do you get fired? How are you not a good floor mopper? Huh? Especially when the floor you're mopping is a UPS concrete floor. I mean, you know, it doesn't have to be clean enough to eat off of. I got fired from that job. And so had you asked any of my friends, anybody that knew me, hey, based on what you see in Billy's freshman year of college, how would you score him on a scale of 1 to 10? And I'll be honest with you, I probably would not have gotten a 2 or a 3, and that might have been generous. I wonder how the human race would be scored. If we looked at the human race throughout history, especially, I mean, forget perfection, all right? We're not even talking about perfection. We're talking about just a general standard of goodness, if we could even define goodness as people who love other people, and maybe they sin every now and then. They're not perfect, but they're generally good people. How would how would humanity as a race score over the course of history? And I got to tell you, when I think about that and I look at, I try to be realistic and I look at what we have done and what we continue to do, I have to say, I think there would be some bad news if we really got scored on how good we were. I think all the way back to the beginning. I think about Adam and Eve and how they failed at living a perfect life. I think about the generation of Noah. The generation of Noah, big fail. I think about God finally puts the nation of Israel together, and He literally does everything from give them meat when they're tired of eating bread, to giving them bread, to giving them water out of the rocks, to, I mean, literally walking with them, a cloud in the daytime and a pillar of fire at night so that they don't get lost, because they didn't have MapQuest like we do. And, I mean, God was their MapQuest, and still, they failed. They're living a good life. I see some of y'all grinning. Some of y'all get lost with MapQuest, don't you? Even with MapQuest. I understand. God sent prophets to them to warn them, to say, hey, you guys better watch out. Y'all better straighten up because God's not pleased with the way you're living. You're not doing what you agreed to do, what you committed to do. And they killed those guys. About 150 years before Christ came, the Jews still had the law, all right? They still had the law. They still, there was still a core group of Jews, a remnant, so to speak, that were trying to live godly lives, and they really wanted to obey the law. And so what came out of that 150 years before Christ was these religious leaders. And we know them as the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and they're also called the teachers of the law. They're also called lawyers experts in the law, depending on what version of the Gospels that you were reading from. And so you got this group of people at this point in history, by the time Jesus comes on the scene, and they so want to be those people. They want to be, they look back and they recognize that it had been a fail, total failure on humanity's part to live good lives. And so they zeroed in on the law. They zeroed in on rules. And Jesus comes along. And if you remember last week, I mentioned Matthew chapter 23, the seven woes. And literally, Jesus did not appreciate their strategy whatsoever. And Jesus' reaction to them was very harsh, and it was very brutal. And we look at the world today. And we look at the wars and all that we fight, but we look at the injustice, the way we treat each other. And if you look at it all the way from sort of the outside of the onion, so to speak, if you're peeling off layers, and you see the wars that we fight, people that we don't even know, and then you see how humanity treats folks, you know, within the same region, and then how we treat one another, you know, in our neighborhoods, at work, at school, and then you go all the way down to literally our families and how we treat one another in our families often. And I wonder how God would score us. We know that sin is the culprit. We know that sin is the problem. It always has been. It's been the problem since Adam and Eve. And it isn't just that sometimes we talk about there being a lack of knowledge, hence you know, our Bible classes and the study that we try to do, and we really want to get that knowledge, but you know, these folks didn't fail because they had a lack of knowledge. We're going to be looking at Romans today, and in Romans chapter 1, verse 28, Paul said that they didn't think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God. So the fail wasn't because there was a lack of knowledge. There was plenty of teaching going on. It was because they didn't listen to the knowledge that they had. They didn't obey the knowledge that they had. It wasn't due to the fact that some of them were in the wrong family or the wrong group or whatever. The text also says in Romans chapter 3, it says that even Gentiles and Jews all sin. They've all been separated from God. Whether you were a Jew, part of God's children, that nation that he built, through whom would come Jesus. Whether you were a Jew or a Gentile, it wasn't the issue. It wasn't due to your heritage or your family. It also was not due to the fact that you just didn't put forth enough effort. You know, sometimes, and it's true, sometimes we don't put forth enough effort in any area of my life. When I look back at that freshman year of college, dismal lack of effort, y'all. Dismal lack of effort. No effort whatsoever. I didn't try at all. I didn't try much better than that in high school. I blame that on Lisa because she was too pretty and I always wanted to look at her. Sometimes it is a lack of effort. But the reason we fail to be good people, to live godly lives, is generally not due to a lack of effort. Paul also says there that, in essence, if you try to be righteous by the law, you're going to fail every time. There is no amount of effort that is going to allow you to do that. And here's the really bad news, all right? Remember we talked about bad news and good news? We're going to see the bad news first, and then we're going to end on the good news, because it would be horrible to start with the good news and end on the bad news today. The bad news is, as Paul says in Romans chapter 3, verse 10, read it along on the screen with me, there is no one who is righteous. Not even one. Not the people with the law or the people without the law. Not the people who tried really hard or those who didn't try at all. Not the folks from the best family or the right heritage or the proper lineage or the ones without the right heritage or family or lineage. Now, it's quiet in here. It's really quiet. Let that sink in for a minute. There is no one righteous. Not even one. The best person you know. We all have that person in our life, maybe two or three of them, that we would think, man, do they even sin? You know, I've never seen them do anything wrong, heard them say anything wrong, can't see inside their head, but can't imagine by that angelic face they could ever even think anything wrong. Not even one. No one righteous. Now imagine if that were the end of the story. Imagine if that were the end of the story and there was literally no hope. And those two words, I find those two words to be, or that phrase of two words to be, one of the most miserable phrases or thoughts that I can conjure. No hope. Imagine a situation in which there is absolutely no hope. Zero, zilch, nada. No hope whatsoever. And I began to think, as I was thinking about what would it be like to just live with no hope. And I thought about, man, what if there was a plague in which 100% fatal? What if there was a plague that killed everybody that it came in contact with? That would sort of be a situation where there would be no hope. And I look back through history, and the worst plague, according to Wikipedia, was the bubonic plague, otherwise known as the Black Plague, back in the 13th century. And over in Europe, some say it might have killed as many as 200 to 250 million people, which was half the population of Europe at the time. And so, dismal outlook if you had if you got the Black Plague, but you still had about a 50-50 shot. There was hope. Even in the darkest of those circumstances, there was hope. Folks, the sin plague, Paul says, is worse. There is no hope. No hope whatsoever. There is no one righteous, no, not one. No hope for humanity, No hope for our children. Imagine living with that knowledge and realizing that this baby that I brought into the world, they're going to grow up and they're going to sin. They're going to go the way of me, their mother, everybody else in history, and they're going to wind up in hell. They're going to hear those damnation words just like everybody else. No hope whatsoever. One could surely wish or desire not to bring another life, another soul into this world if that were the case. No hope whatsoever. And of course we know we're not living in a time of no hope. We're not living in a situation of no hope. Even though we all know our sin, we recognize our faults and our struggles, and even we can look back at those times when we were living in one big, great fail like I was my freshman year of college, or maybe we're in that right now and we're living the up-close and personal consequences of our own sin, of our own failures. There's good news. In Romans chapter 5, verse 8, Paul says, while we were still sinners, Christ died for the ungodly. And I realize that that is a very familiar passage to us. We've heard it a lot. We've heard classes on it. We've heard sermons on it. We've read it. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for the ungodly. You know, as a parent, how easy is it when your child comes to you broken, weeping, repentant over something that they had done? How easy is it to forgive them when they're like that? That's an easy, easy forgive, isn't it? They don't even have to ask. We can see it, and we know they're just being eaten alive by whatever they've done to their brother or sister or to the kid down the street. And man, that conscience is really, really being tweaked. And it's so easy to forgive them. It's so easy to gather them up in our arms and comfort them and assure them that they're loved and that God is not angry with them and neither are we. But what about when your child is unrepentant completely? I mean, angry, hostile. I remember this time when our oldest son, Cale, was about 4 years old. We were living in Laplace, Louisiana, and we got invited over to some folks' house from our church who were about our age, all young marrieds, and had kids around Cale's age. And we were invited over there for, it was sort of like a, just to get together, it was kind of like a life group. And we sang songs and the kids played, and we all really enjoyed the fellowship. And when it came time to go, Cale tried to get out the door with the kid who lived there, one of his toys. And we said, Cale, you can't take that. That's not your toy. Yes, it is. No, it's not. We knew that it wasn't his toy. He knew that it wasn't his toy. That kid surely knew that it wasn't his toy. In fact, by the time we were done literally prying that toy out of his fingers, everybody in the house knew that my son had tried to steal another kid's toy. I mean, fail as a parent. There was no way we could recover from that. In fact, it was a really ugly scene, and we did not spare the rod, I got to tell you, that night. We did not. And it was really hard to extend grace to him. That was the situation with a missionary by the name of Don Richardson. Don Richardson, his wife, went to the small Pacific island of New Guinea to be missionaries. And they made contact with a tribe of folks that lived out in the bush, a tribal people known as the Sawis. And it's spelled S-A-W-I if you want to Google it sometime and just read about them. But the Sawis were known to be very violent. They were cannibalistic. They were known as a headhunter tribe. And somehow Don and his wife We're able to make some inroads, made some friends with among them, and we're invited to live with them, even as they struggled with a way to figure out how they could share the gospel with these people. And they tried over and over and over, but their culture, the Sahrawi's culture, was so different that the biggest obstacle was that they couldn't understand the idea of love and forgiveness and mercy. And so the story of the good news of Jesus didn't make any sense to them at all. In fact, when he told them the story, they got really excited when he told them about Judas, and they really identified with Judas as the hero in the story because they really loved the idea of a guy being able to betray somebody else and sell that person like Judas did with Jesus. So they identified with Judas more than they could identify with Jesus. And so this struggle continued. And after, as Don tells the story, after the 14th bloody battle right outside his hut in that village, where the Sahrawis and their mortal enemies, the Hanum tribe, who had raided their enclosure, whatever they lived in, after the 14th bloody battle over a couple of year time span happened right in front of their home, they finally decided, you know what, it's time to pack it in. These people they're not going to understand, they're not going to accept it. We are failing here to make an impact with the gospel in this place. And the Sahrawis didn't want them to leave. And so they put together this elaborate celebration, this elaborate ceremony right in front of their house. And they invited the other tribe to come in, the Hanums. And so the Hanums and the Sahrawis, all apart from each other, and they invited Don and his wife to come out and watch the ceremony. And everybody was silent except for the Sahrawi chief's wife, because the Sahrawi chief walked over and ripped her six-month-old baby out of her arms. And as she wailed, he held that baby up like the Lion King, and he walked over to the Hanums and he handed that baby to the chief. And then they explained to Don and his wife that what was taking place was they were going to give their child to this other tribe to be renamed and live as one of their people. And that as long as that baby survived, there would never be war between them. They called it the peace child. They used the baby to procure peace between the two tribes. And as Don sat there and watched that, he realized, I finally have an inroad. I finally have a way to help them understand what God has done for us. You see, the point he was going to be able to make, and he ended up being able to make and stayed there to minister among the Sahrawis and converting many of them to the cause of Christ, was that God sent Jesus as his peace child. While we were still sinners, Christ died for the ungodly. Put that verse sort of in context with what God has done for us, and you realize it isn't just that we were this kid who came running to Him repentant and begging for mercy. And how easy that might have been for God. Okay, yeah, I was a sinner, but I was willing to repent. So God, God opened His arms. No, while we were still sinners, in other words, while we were at war with God, while you were still rebellious in your sin, while you were angry and hostile to God, before you even realized that you needed to be saved, God gave Jesus as our peace child. Now, is that good news or what? It's great news. I think that's what Romans 5:8 means. Before we even knew that there was a problem, Even maybe when we were still in our anger and rebellion, God looked at you and he saw you as someone worthy of saving. I want to give you a couple of applications and then the lesson will be yours. First of all, I want to challenge you to think about a time when you were living in rebellion. Maybe it's right now. Maybe there's something in your life where you know you're in active rebellion with the God of the universe, the God who gave his son as a sacrificial peace child for you. Jesus made the to the cross. And I want to invite you, I want to challenge you to let that change your prayer time this week. Think about that rebellion in your life. Think about that rebellion at some point in your life, if you've already surrendered that to God. Let that give you an attitude of gratitude, a sense of the goodness of God's plan to send Jesus. And secondly, we have been invited to share in Jesus' death, his burial, and his resurrection through baptism. And in baptism, we die to ourselves. We reenact the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. We die to ourselves. We are buried, and then we are raised, believing and trusting. You see, the gospel, folks, that's not the gospel. The gospel is what Jesus did. That's the good news. But he's waiting for our response. He's waiting for our steps towards him. This morning, if there is rebellion in your life that you need to hand over to God, or at least acknowledge to God that you know is there, we want to encourage you to do that this morning. If you need to do it in a public way, then we are ready to greet you, to pray with you and for you. If you feel like that would be a good thing to let this body know that you need prayers, we're here for you. But also if you've never begun that walk, if you haven't stepped towards God and responded to the good news of what he has done for us by being buried with Christ in baptism, believing and trusting that Jesus is your peace child, please come as we sing.